Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times best-selling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. And you sort of broke my spirits in a recent Florida Phoenix column, Craig, because I...
Welcome to Florida.
Yeah, that's the show. Wrap it up.
Yeah.
I had heard for a long time about this project in Collier County, which is Southwest Florida. It's the heart of Panther country that is facing escalating and rapid and rampant development, about potentially working with developers, conservation groups to set aside a big chunk of land, preserve it as natural habitat for the panther. But that recently, from your article, fizzled out.
Yeah. How can I explain this? Almost always, whenever you run into an environmental issue in Florida, there are two ways to approach it. There is the environmental groups that say, we need to cut the best deal we can because we can't rely on the regulators to do their jobs, because frequently they don't.
Yeah.
So those folks go in and try and work things out. And that's what was happening with this habitat conservation plan. Defenders of Wildlife in particular was working with the East Collier property owners to try and set aside a huge swath of land that is already panther habitat, and to keep it and to maintain it and to cluster the development close to Immokalee so it wouldn't turn into, you know, the typical suburban sprawl we have today.
Right. And you're talking about 200,000 acres. I mean, this was a considerable chunk of land.
Yeah. And so, and then on the other side, you have the people who are the absolute hardliners, and they will fight to the death to stop things going wrong for the environment. Mm-hmm. And even if that risks complete failure. And, you know, I can't say one's right and one's wrong. It all kind of depends on the outcome. And so the people who were working on this habitat conservation plan worked on it for 12 very long years.
12 years. And, amazing.
Yeah. Isn't that incredible? And they thought they'd come up with something good and presented it to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And the Fish and Wildlife Service was like, this isn't quite it. This is not going to work, because there was not enough protection in there for panthers from being run over by cars and trucks, which, you know, that's the main cause of death for panthers these days. And so,
because while this land set aside would be set aside from development, but it would still have roads going through it
with, and without, and 200,000 new cars and trucks driving on those roads. And so and the property owners were like, well, we shouldn't be held responsible for what drivers do, you know, that are on roads outside our development. And feds were like, well, that's not good enough. And so they hit an impasse. The developers went to the very top. They hired a Washington attorney to get the ear of the head of the Fish and Wildlife Service during the Trump administration. She told him she'd look into it, but nothing ever happened. And finally, last week, they just said, that's it. We're pulling the plug. We're not going to pursue this anymore. And instead, we're going to do it piecemeal the way everybody else does it. And the folks,
which is kind of the worst case scenario.
Yeah. Well, except maybe it's better than it was. The experts I talked to, well, first, let me just say, folks from Defenders of Wildlife, they're heartbroken because they feel like this is a missed opportunity. And I can see their point of view. But on the other hand, the Conservancy is like, look, we pointed out a problem and they wouldn't fix the problem. They were too cheap to spend the money to do it right. And so if you're not going to do that, then you're not really protecting the panthers. And I can see that viewpoint as well.
Yeah.
So
the wildlife overpasses and underpasses. They've got one in California that goes over the 101 freeway. I mean,
I wrote about that for Scientific American. It's the largest wildlife overpass in the world.
It's like a 10-lane highway in near downtown Los Angeles. Right.
Yeah.
And it's been wildly successful. They aren't particularly expensive. I don't understand.
Well,
you know, there are ways to get around. I guess that is in the eye of the beholder, I suppose.
Anytime you're spending a lot of money on concrete, you're going to spend a lot of money. But if you value panthers, and as we say we do, if they are the state animal that we want to preserve, then we should be willing to spend a lot of money on saving them, you know, as a valuable member of our landscape, as a valuable part of the ecosystem.
Yeah.
And the developers here were not willing to do that. They just said, screw it. We're not going to do it. So my column basically said they're too cheap to do it the right way.
Yeah.
And, course, already people are like, how dare you? Well, okay. You know, that's the way I see it.
Yeah. Developers are always the bad guys. They wear the black hat. They again do so here, but it also is an interesting story about, like you said, that push and pull between compromise or dig your heels into the sand with conservation groups. And, it's a philosophical debate, like you say, that doesn't really have, you know, there's certainly one side is more practical, you know, the other side can say, you know, we're more, principled, but it's hard, you know.
Yeah. That's tough. I mean, what counts are the results, and, you know, if you get the right results, great. If you don't, was it really worth what you gave up? I don't know.
FloridaPhoenix.com. Every Thursday, Craig has a new article or column there, and it's a great publication beyond the environment as well for covering Florida politics and news. I'm at FloridaPhoenix.com all the time. Want to remind you once again about the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Arts new exhibition, Black Pioneers: Legacy in the American West. This went on view September 3rd. It will run through January 8th, 2023. The exhibition is the first of its kind, exploring the path of Black history in the West with a timeline of original pictorial quilts. And that begins all the way back in 1528, which marked the arrival of Africans in the American West. It continues up through the civil rights movement, dispelling the myth that Black people in the Old West were mostly cowboys. Black Pioneers: Legacy in the American West shows this rich diversity of their occupations and their achievements in society, religion, education, and the arts. The quilts are gorgeous. The history is important. The location is one of my favorites in all of the state. It's the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art right there in downtown St. Petersburg, Florida. And also, we are now smack dab in the midst of hurricane season. Oh, yeah. And have you ever had to fill up sandbags, Craig? You ever get worried that, oh my God.
Never had to fill up sandbags, but Lord knows I've seen a lot of other people do them. I should mention, we just had the 30th anniversary of Hurricane Andrew.
Absolutely.
We just went by where lots of people had experience with sandbags and other stuff.
No question about it. One time here in Fernandina Beach, we were in the path of a storm, and my house is in a lower-lying area that would experience some flooding if there was a catastrophe. So I actually went to, you know, the city park where, you know, the city of Fernandina Beach and Nassau County just brought in dump truck after dump truck after dump truck of sand. And then they put out some shovels and some bags and said, have at it. And there were people lined up there, you know, shoveling sand into bags. It's pouring down rain. You put that stuff in your car, it's a total mess. And, you know, I brought it home and put it on my, you know, back door. And it was a total disaster. Unfortunately, it didn't end up flooding, but I was left with, you know, a huge mess in my car, a huge mess in my lawn, a huge mess in the house from all of this stuff. Well, there is a product from our friends at windstormproducts.com called the Quick Dam that takes the place of dozens of sandbags and all the hassle. It's these 5 and 10 foot quick dams, which are bags essentially that you lay at your entryway into your house or your garage
or
your shed. Yeah, the threshold. And when the water comes by, they just fill up. It's the most remarkable thing. I'm going to put a link to the video down in the show notes. But instead of the backbreaking labor and hours and mess of sandbags, a $25 box of these quick dams will do the work of all of them. And then when you want to get rid of them, if they're full of water, you just pop a hole in them and let them drain out. Or if they don't fill up, you just keep them for next time and throw them away. It's an amazing product. And not just for hurricanes. Obviously, you know, in Florida, we get more sunny day flooding. You know, if you've got a low-lying area where every time it rains hard, you get some water inundation. Quick Dam Flood Barrier is something you want to check out. And you can find that as well at windstormproducts.com. And that takes us to this week's guest, who is Moni Basu, a Florida journalism professor, University of Florida journalism professor. She wrote an article that goes way beyond most when considering Casadega, the so-called psychic capital of the world.
Yes. I should mention that, you know, for years, I've sort of had the attitude characterized by, pick a good example, Dave Barry, the famous Florida humorist, who wrote in his book, Best State Ever, that if Casadega really is the psychic capital of America, how come they don't win the lottery every week? You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, already casting doubt on, yeah, maybe this whole thing's a scam after all. But when I read Moni's story in Flamingo magazine, I thought I was really impressed because it was not that sort of jokey, you know, hey, yeah, let's go in and write about all the scamsters. But instead, it was a much more penetrating look at the historical and religious aspects of what's going on there. And I thought it was fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
Let's get to it.
Moni, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. How did you get interested in the topic of Casadega, Florida's famous town?
I had seen signs for it during my travels in Central Florida, and it kept popping up in a lot of travel brochures as this weird, one of the many weird places in Florida that you must go to see and go get your, you know, palm read and tarot cards. And that was a town filled with people who were a little bit out there. So I Googled it and I came across a bunch of stories in newspapers and magazines. And all of them sort of portrayed the town as this kooky place that people go to visit. But I also came across an article that talked about how it was home to the largest spiritualist camp in the Southeast, if not in all of America, and that there was a history behind that spiritualist movement. And I started doing a little bit of reading about what spiritualists believe, and decided that I was fascinated by it because I was raised in India. And even though my parents weren't particularly religious, my extended family was. And I had grown up with these concepts of, you know, what happens to your soul after you die, after your body physically dies, what happens? You know, we didn't really believe in this notion of heaven or hell. Hinduism believes that your soul goes free after you die. And so I thought, wow, there's a lot of similarities here between Eastern beliefs from the Indian subcontinent and what's going on in the spiritualist movement. And there's another thing. I had a student in the MFA program at the University of Georgia who had been researching a woman who was a spiritualist. And so I had heard her talk a lot about her and the history of the spiritualist movement in America. And so I pitched the story to Flamingo. And I said, I don't want to write the travel story about the kooky place. I want to really go find out what's going on there. And so I went and spent a weekend down there. And I had not intended actually to write a first person piece. But once I got there and experienced it for a couple of days, I went back to Jamie Rich at Flamingo and I told her, I want to write this as a journey story, my journey to this place that everyone thinks it's A, but really it's the farthest thing from A for the people who live there. And I want to write about how I came upon this place and the emotions and really my emotions. I was surprised by my own emotions that weekend. And I want to write about that in some way. And so she gave me the freedom to do it. And it turned out to be the piece that it was.
Now, tell us a little bit about how this spiritual movement resulted in the founding of this particular spiritualist camp in Florida.
Right. So the spiritualist movement in America was born in upstate New York, really, and had ties to the Seneca Indians up in upstate New York. And at some point, the man who was one of the founders of that movement decided that, he claims he was guided by a Seneca Indian spirit in coming south, coming across this place. And, you know, at that time, this is in the 1800s, you can imagine what Central Florida was like back then. There was not much there. It was pretty rough country, but he fell in love with it. He just thought the land was beautiful. The weather was certainly a lot better than winters in upstate New York. And I guess he came to Florida for a lot of the same reasons that many of us came to Florida for. But he ended up found, you know, it started as a summer camp for this group in upstate New York. And eventually it grew and grew and grew and became this large, almost like a, you know, what it is today is almost like a city within the city of Casadega, if you can call it a city. It's really a village. But that's how it started, with people from upstate New York who came down south and wanted to spread their beliefs, or wanted to practice, not spread, I shouldn't say spread, wanted to practice their beliefs in a place that they found, that they connected with spiritually. Mm-hmm. You know, they thought the land was beautiful.
Give us the Cliff Notes sort of summary of what spiritualism is.
Okay, let me think about that for a minute. Spiritualism. People who are spiritualists believe that when you die, you again, you physically die, but that your soul, your spirit, lives on, and that the living, those of us who are still physically living on Earth, can then connect with our ancestors, with our loved ones, with the spirits of our loved ones. And so, for instance, when you have a reading done by a medium, and there's a lot of hokiness to this now, people taking advantage of it, but a real medium, someone who's really doing this work, is someone who has that ability to connect with the spirits. And can, if I went to have a reading done, and this woman that did the reading for me asked me, you know, about the people in my life. And I told her, you know, both my parents died a long time ago, and I was very close to both of them. But I think a lot about my mom, and I feel that my mother is with me a lot of the time. And so she did this reading for me where she actually told me things that my mother was doing in that other spiritual world. And it's a really hard concept for most of us to grasp in the Judeo-Christian world, where our beliefs are very different. But if you think about it as like we, you know, Christians and Muslims, we believe that when you die, you either gain salvation or not. You either go to heaven or hell. And that's why you should be a good person in life, because if you're a bad person, you'll go to hell. And there's also this idea that if you repent at the end of your life and accept Christ as your savior, that you will have a chance at a good afterlife. But the spiritualists are very much in line with the Hindus. They believe in this concept of like karma, like your life's actions are very, very important. You can't just like make your say sorry at the end and be all good. So that's part of their belief. And I also met this elderly couple who ended up being in the story, but a lot of their story wasn't in the story I published because it was just getting to be too long. Mm-hmm. But this woman, this woman in her 90s, told me that the partner she was with now, that they had been romantically involved in past lives. She really believed that. Mm-hmm. And that she even had certain memories of it. I'm not sure I believe all that, but it was certainly a sort of a reporting trip that made me stop and think a lot about life and death issues and what happens to us after we die. And, you know, I'm going to be 60 in October, so I'm not a spring chicken anymore. And I think a lot more about my own mortality these days. Anyone who gets to, you know, go after, I think 50 is probably that point in our lives when we, after we cross 50, we begin thinking about these things a lot more. And so that whole reporting trip was just fascinating for me. It's not that I came away believing everything that those people believe, but it just made me stop and think and ponder. Mm-hmm. And very deeply, like I had never done before.
Well, and to that point, then, what is lost about Casadega when the focus is strictly on it's kooky and it's weird and it's strange and it's sort of this oddball attraction right there off the interstate near Deltona between Orlando and Daytona, as opposed to what you went there and found for yourself?
Yeah, so actually the people who are true believers, true spiritualists, they actually sort of despise the outer ring of people who have set up the crystal shops and the psychic readings and the tarot card readings. There's a whole business there. There's a whole industry there that takes advantage.
Like it's like there's two Casadegas.
There's two Casadegas. Yes.
Yeah.
There's the old spiritualist camp, and those people live right in the town within the camp's borders. And then there's the outer ring outside of the camp. And those are the hokey, kooky people who just take advantage of tourists, who see, you know, road signs on the interstate, or they picked up some travel brochure at the Holiday Inn that says, oh, if you're going to Orlando, take a few minutes to drive up Interstate 4 and check out this place. And I met people like that who said, oh, this is just a fun place to come spend the day. We have tarot card readings and psychic readings, and we buy some crystals, and we have a nice lunch at the old hotel, and then they're on their way. But that's not what this story was about. This story was about the people who have, for some of them, for generations, lived there and practiced their religion there. And it is a religion. Their numbers have gone down, but at one point, I don't remember the number that was in the story, but at one point there were, you know, quite a thousands and thousands of Americans who were part of the spiritualist movement. I found that fascinating.
Tell us a little bit about the hotel. You stayed in the hotel, right?
Yeah, the Casadega Hotel. That is like, talk about folklore. I mean, you could sit there in the lobby for hours and hours and have the hotel manager tell you stories about that hotel. And I had an upstairs room. All the rooms are, you know, this is a Victorian age hotel. It's been burned down a couple of times, so a lot of it has been rebuilt, but it still feels like that. And the rooms are very Victorian in the sense that the sinks, you know, are not in the bathrooms, but in the bedroom themselves, which is how it used to be when people had to use outhouses. And the hallway, the upstairs hallway, is lined with mirrors, because the idea is that at night you might see a spirit's reflection in the mirror. Uh-huh. And so I got up in the middle of the night and walked outside my room to look for spirits. I didn't see any, but maybe that's because ye of little faith, right?
I'm sure they were just taking a bathroom break.
Yeah, they might have been doing that, because other people who stayed at that hotel and the manager and the shop owner told me that, oh no, we see spirits all the time, this person and that person, and there's certain rooms that are haunted. But even the hotel, you know, the true spiritualists in the town have some problems with the hotel, because there are people who do mediums, who do readings. I think there was a photo of one of the rooms that ran with my story that had wild paintings on the wall. And there was a woman who was doing readings up there. And I'm not sure how the true spiritualists, you know, whether they would condone that or not. But the hotel is a fun place. They have a restaurant. They have karaoke on Saturday nights.
Really?
Yeah. I went there in the middle of COVID, and I was hesitant to go in there, but I did. I put on my mask and went in there, and it was just the wildest thing. It was like this Victorian hotel that was allegedly haunted with spirits. And there was the bar was packed, and people were doing karaoke and drinking a lot of beer. And
that's how you see the spirits.
Sure, it helps if you've had a few drinks in you.
Roughly how many people are in the spiritualist community there now? What size?
So the numbers have dwindled. I don't know the exact number, but I would say it's fewer than 100 now.
Yeah.
But at one point there were quite a few people who lived there. It's a charming little village. The houses are old, you know, and some of them have been lovingly restored. Others are in need of TLC. But the people who actually live in the village are, you know, some of them have lived there for years and years and years. There's nothing there in Casadega. You have to drive to DeLand. DeLand is the closest town to Casadega, where you could go to a Publix or a shop, you know, grocery shopping or hardware store, whatever it is. There's nothing in Casadega. There's the spiritualist camp that has the church, and they have a little, you know, bookstore. They do tours, orb tours. I had booked a ticket, you know, to go on an orb tour, and then typical of Florida, at 5 p.m., the heavens opened up, and it was like massive downpour, and the orb tour was canceled that weekend, so I couldn't go on that. But allegedly, people see orbs on this tour.
Now, what are orbs? What do you mean by that?
Lights, the spirit's light, you know? Mm-hmm. I did not witness that, so I can't say that I've seen that. Maybe I should go back to see that one day.
For those of us who haven't been there, and myself included, you talk about this village with the church and the bookstore and these houses. Is it obviously apparent when you've found the actual, the historic village, I guess, for lack of a better word, or is it sort of intermingled, interspersed with the rest of the town? Set a scene for us as you, as a traveler, are coming upon this spiritualist community there.
Right. So when you drive into town, one of the first things you see is the hotel. It's just the biggest building there. And it's a beautiful old building. And then there's a main street that goes right in front of the hotel. The bookstore is on there. The church is at one end of it. And then there is behind all that is a residential community where the actual spiritualists live. There's not much more to the town. There's a few houses surrounding the town where other folks live, but that's about it. It's a really, I mean, calling it a town is being generous. It's mm-hmm. really a village, you know, a little hamlet. It's a very cute little hamlet. It's very well taken care of. The people who live there are very proud of their history and want to make sure that there's not development and encroachment and that they preserve the history that is left there. But I don't know how much to say about the intermingling, because I don't know that there too many people who are not part of that movement actually live in Casadega. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of folks who run like some of the psychic shops and crystal shops and do these psychic readings don't even live there. They come in from DeLand and other places for the day.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. What's in the bookstore? Do they have like, you know, what's on the New York Times bestseller list, or is it all spiritualist stuff?
It's spiritualist stuff. Yes. It's all about the philosophy. It's about some big figures in the spiritualist movement. There is some philosophy books in there, but yes, it's all has to do with the spiritualist movement.
Politically, socially, were they always able to get along with their neighbors and vice versa? I shouldn't say it's their, responsibility to get along with their neighbors. We hear so much in Florida, obviously, about, you know, African Americans or Native Americans, obviously, being persecuted for who they are and their beliefs. Was there any of that with this group? Because you're talking about coming here in a Civil War era times.
Yeah, so I don't know exactly if there had been friction back then, but I wrote in my story that one of the reasons you asked me why I decided to do the story. Another interesting facet for me was this was in the heart of Trump country, you know, and that was obvious to me when I was driving down from Gainesville. There were Trump Pence signs all over the place, people who fly giant American flags, and I can only imagine what their politics are. Mm-hmm. So this is a pretty conservative part of Florida, a solid red part of Florida. And I thought it was fascinating that there was this spiritualist camp whose beliefs certainly would have been radical to Southern Baptists or other conservative Christians who might be living in the area. So that I found that part of it mm-hmm. fascinating too. It was like this bubble. I can't call it a blue bubble because I don't know what their politics are. I didn't go down there to discuss that.
No political signs in the yards or anything like that.
No, there were no political signs in the yards. But obviously their thinking was very, very different. Their mm-hmm. outlook on life was clearly very different than the people surrounding them, you know. And I thought it must have been fascinating for them to have survived the Civil War and then Reconstruction and the whole, the years of Jim Crow. I mean, that part of Florida must have been brutal, brutal for people of color to live in. But, you know, this is largely a white, you know, these people are mostly white people. And so they didn't have to deal with the race factor, right? But they did have to deal with like people looking at them and saying, you kooks, get out. You know, they were kooky to most people who lived there. And so that was another reason I wanted to go and discover this place, because it was in such an unlikely part of Florida. I mean, if it was in the middle of Tallahassee, that would have been, you know, okay, I get it. I get it, you know?
Yeah.
But in where it's geographically, it didn't make sense to me. But then I learned this history of how this man was guided by his Indian native spirit to this spot and fell in love with it when he got there from the beauty of the land.
You mentioned about development. I'm just curious, you know, it seems like development popping up in all kinds of unlikely places these days. Has there been any signs of it encroaching on Casadega yet?
Not so far. You have to get off the interstate and take Casadega Road, and you have to go a few miles on Casadega Road. So it's quite, I would say it's about 10 miles off Interstate 4. And there's nothing around there. Like I said, there's not even a grocery store. You know, it's kind of a food desert, actually. You have to drive to Deland to do anything. So there, so far, there's no signs of encroachment. But as we all know, you know, who knows what's going to happen? I mean, my guess is in a few years, suburban Orlando is going to be right there, you know, the way Orlando's growing and stretching.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's going to happen. All that land, the spiritualist camp owns quite a few acres of land there. And so that's privately owned by them. Mm-hmm. But they, I don't know. I couldn't tell you what the situation is with the surrounding land, who owns it, whether it's state land or, you know.
You talk about how the numbers of this community are dwindling. What are we looking at? Another generation here? Is it important to them to hold on, or when this just up and fades away entirely, is that fine? What is the future for this community?
Well, the people who I talked to there who are part of this movement are continuing full steam. The woman who did my reading, for instance, she just bought a house there.
Wow.
She bought a house and fixed it up, and she has her office. She uses that house for her office, and she has another house in Deland. You know, I think it's hard for people to live there. I mean, this is a woman who had a career and then decided that she was going to be a medium full time, but it's hard. I would imagine it would be hard for her to live there full time. So she has a house somewhere else, but she also bought a house there, and people are into like making sure that the village stays intact. But yeah, I mean, there are a lot of older folks there, and I don't know what's going to happen in the next generation.
Yeah, it's like a lot of older churches these days that are.
Yes, exactly. Most of the people I spoke with were in their 60s, 70s, and that woman who was in her 90s. So it's not a place where lots of young people are flocking to, but I did go to Sunday service there. And at Sunday service, I would say there were younger folks who came to the service.
Were they coming to participate, or were they coming to spectate at something unusual?
So I didn't talk to all of them, but I do know that several of them were there to participate.
Fascinating.
And I talked to a couple of folks who go there every week. That's their church service. And I thought the service was for someone who, an outsider, it was welcoming and inclusive. And even if you didn't believe everything, that the sermon was really more about life than it was about, you know, there was no proselytizing or, you know, trying to tell you, look, this is our religion and you got to believe this and this is the only way. I've been to services like that too, right? But this was very inclusive, and I felt sort of enlightened when I walked out of there, like, okay, I've got energy for the whole week.
Wow. But did they pass the offering plate? That's the key question.
I think they did pass an officer. Yeah. I don't remember that, actually. Don't quote me on that. I don't remember that.
So that branding as the psychic capital of the world, is that fair?
No.
No.
I don't know where that came from. That is some Florida PR person who came up with that for a travel brochure.
It's probably on a motel placemat.
Yeah, there you go. You know, there's like the mermaids at WikiWatchy, and then there's the psychic capital of the world. It's that kind of branding. But no, I don't think that's fair to call it that. It's a really small place. You know, if you read the brochures and if you look at the signs, you feel like you're going to go to this, you know, like another magic kingdom, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not that. It's very low key. And it was just interesting, the people I met who had come there. There was one woman whose father died recently, and she came because she felt some kind of connection with him after his death and wanted to explore that more. She was very serious about going to the services and talking to the folks there. And then there were other people there, young folks from Orlando, who just thought it would be a fun thing to do on a Saturday afternoon. Yeah. And I talked to them while they were drinking wine on the patio of the hotel. Wide variety of people. There's a lovely park there, you know, a little trail and a park in a wooded area. It's just a quaint little place, but it's not big. And so to call it the psychic capital of the world, that's, I would say, is a little bit of an exaggeration, or maybe a lot of an exaggeration.
Moni Basu from University of Florida journalism professor, who wrote this Flamingo magazine article recently all about Casadega and the spiritualist community that lives there. Moni, thank you so much for your time today. An interesting slice of Florida life here we were unaware of.
Thank you for having me. I so appreciate this opportunity.
Reminds me, Craig, of the episode we did. What was the one where the group that was certainly more of a cult than this a religion that believed the
allure of immortality? Yes,
the world was inside out or something like that.
Yes, that was Lynn Milner, her book on the Khorasans.
That's right.
Thought that the world was hollow and we lived inside it, and that their leader would reincarnate, and then surprisingly he didn't.
Which is now a state park, correct?
Right, it's now a state park.
And a little bit. Go ahead.
I was just to say, and remember we talked to the author of In the Land of Good Living, Ken Russell, who went to Casadega and said that the guy who did his reading then tried to rope him into a real estate scam. So I guess your experience varies according to your expectations.
Yeah, very, very interesting. But, you know, coming into this episode, I had no idea that there was an actual religious community there. I thought this was just some strange place where all these charlatans just happened to sort of find an interstate exit where, you know, they could, you know, join forces and get their businesses up and running.
All the swamis from Gibsonton migrated there.
Well, it goes along with this season three theme of kind of undiscovered Florida. You know, Casadega, maybe you've heard of it, maybe you haven't. I mean, I have heard of it. And again, with the psychic capital of the world branding, but had no idea that there's actually depth there. You know?
Yeah. And that's why I wanted to talk to Moni about it, because I haven't seen anybody else come into this situation and write about it seriously the way she did. Mm-hmm. You know, as she mentioned, there's been lots of stories of, oh, look at this wacky thing. Yeah. But this was she took it very seriously and explored it much more deeply than other writers I've seen.
Yeah. The link to that Flamingo article is in the show notes. And as always, we want to thank Visit Sarasota for sponsoring the podcast. And I was scrolling through the Visit Sarasota County Instagram profile recently and came across this interesting tidbit, and that Sarasota has its own award-winning distillery, and that's Siesta Key Rum. They've got a tasting room where visitors can sample the toasted coconut, spiced coffee, and silver rums. Distillery tours learn all about the secrets of their story, and the gift shop allows you to take home a bottle or two. I will put a link to Siesta Key Rum in the show notes, and be sure to follow Sarasota on social media. It's Visit Sarasota on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube, and Visit Sarasota County on Instagram. And one of those episodes of Welcome to Florida that was focused on Visit Sarasota had an Amish flavor to it. So that would be another, you know, group that found itself to Florida on and kind of set up a religious community here.
Absolutely. Florida has always been sort of a haven for religions that are not exactly mainstream. And I think that's a great thing. I really do.
Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.